protecting it in our state law. We did not codify the right to abortion in our state until 2017. So I think that's always interesting. We were one of the first states to not make it illegal before the Roe decision, but we did not codify that right into state law until 2017 with the passage of the Reproductive Health Equity Act and with champions like Speaker Kotek and Governor Brown and, you know, all sorts of, and all are like champions in the Senate and the House. But we worked really hard to be able to elect those pro-sexual and reproductive health care champions. One of the biggest lessons I think we all need to learn is that state elections matter a lot. And with a court that comprised with the individuals that it has now, with those being lifetime appointments, with a number of those justices being very young, it's gonna matter more than ever that we're working hard and not being complacent to make sure that we're voting up and down the ballot for people who are going to protect our fundamental rights and freedoms and expand access to healthcare. Because in the last 4 or 5 years has taught us anything, it is not to take anything for granted and not to feel like you are just safe in your little like corner of the world, because no man is an island. And we should care about what's happening in Texas, and we should care about what's happening in Mississippi, and we should be thinking about how Oregon can be a leader and a beacon for folks who need to get care and might need to travel to our state to do so. Roe has always been the floor, not the ceiling. We know that it has not
you
been
are
enough.
Listening to it's KBOO still not enough that we- Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 10 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler. Excuse me.
Jacqueline Keeler calling. I'd like to welcome you to today's show. This is American Standoff. And today we are going to be looking at today is the National Day of Awareness of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. I'll describe more about it later, but this is happening now, and the City of Portland has been conducting events all week and is conducting events today. And once again, this is American Standoff, and we're a fairly new KBOO show that examines the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. So over a year ago, I always begin with this just to give context to what we're talking about and sort of the framing of this show. On January 6, 2021, we all remember thousands of supporters of former Trump, President Trump, you know, storming the Capitol, claiming that the election had been stolen, trying to force Pence to not certify the election. We had a similar storming of our own state capitol in Salem on December 21st, 2020, just a few weeks earlier. The tower capital was also breached by armed insurrectionists defying COVID restrictions. And so we're looking at sort of where we come in the past year or so. So today on American Standoff, we're discussing the MMIWG Day of Action. The title of the show is the MMIWG, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, Day of Action and Structural Colonial Despair. And that sounds a bit strange, but I will get into more detail on sort of how the structure of colonialism creates the violence we are seeing against Native women and all women in this country, really, and girls as well. So on the show American Standoff, we examine these connections between seemingly disparate events, like what we're seeing today with the Roe v. Wade, the leaked Roe v. Wade, which we'll be discussing as well in depth, the draft decision from the Supreme Court written by Justice Samuel Alito, and how this impacts Native women, and why Native women go missing, and why Native women have such incredibly high rates of murder and rape under a colonial occupation. And so once again, my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am your host. This is a call-in show, so please do call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. And 4 years ago, the U.S. Senate approved a resolution designating May 5th as the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Native Women and Girls. But this year, during the week of MIW events going on across the country, Justice Samuel Alito's draft of a Supreme Court conservative majority preliminary decision was leaked, and the decision would strike down Roe v. Wade. Overnight, women and girls across the country were faced with losing, by possibly the end of the year, the right to an abortion and control over their bodies after 50 years of Roe v. Wade being regarded as settled law in this country. It is estimated that abortion will be outlawed in half the states of the union. Many states have trigger laws already in place to make that so in case the Supreme Court makes a ruling like this. Many of these states include laws that will not allow terminating a pregnancy, even in cases of rape and incest. This follows upon a Texas law that is now in effect that authorizes members of the public to sue anyone who performs or facilitates an illegal abortion for a minimum of $10,000 in statutory damages per abortion, plus court costs and attorney fees. And so let's listen as an introduction to the sort of segueing to the Roe v. Wade issue, and I will explain how that ties into MIW as well. So let's listen to TikTok user Shorty's history, summarize the recent situation regarding Roe v. Wade in a piece he titled SCOTUS, Roe v. Wade Decision is Rooted in 1700s Christianity.
The Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade perpetuates antebellum conservative Christian views of race and gender. Let's start in the 1700s, when Southern evangelical men argued that to maintain order, there were times when Christian men must resort to violence. That's how they justify control over women, Native Americans, and enslaved Africans, while pretending to adhere to Christian virtue. Fast forward to the early 1900s, when white, Native-born Protestant men set out to remasculinize American Christianity. Why? Well, worried that Christian men would develop womanly virtues now that they are working more in factories than on farms. Militant ministers like Billy Sunday began to pack their gospel guns with buttermilk, rough on rats, rock salt, and whatever else came in handy. This description doubled as his pancake recipe. It was also an extension of a patriarchal mindset crafted by white men who ran forced labor camps. In the 1940s, minister Billy Graham burrowed this ideology even deeper into evangelicalism, describing husbands as the protector of the home while saying women were cursed to be under men's rule. In the 50s and 60s, Graham's militant faith was appealing to white Christians concerned about communism and resistant to societal changes like integrating schools. By the 70s, 18% of the U.S. population identified as evangelical, up from 2% in 1942. With that growth came political influence, and white evangelicals helped push Reagan, the Bushes, and Trump into office. Not by coincidence, those four dog whistlers opposed abortion, aka giving women the right to make their own choices and defy a racist, sexist hierarchy devised by white supremacists. Now the conservative members of the Supreme Court are overturning Roe v. Wade and perpetuating a centuries-old buttermilk, rough on rats, rock salt ideology.
So that was TikTok user Shorty's history summarizing our recent situation regarding Roe v. Wade And the piece is titled, A Roe v. Wade Decision is Rooted in 1700s Christianity. So good morning. This is American Standoff. We're a live talk radio show, so please do call in to the studio if you want to be part of this conversation at 503-231-8187. And I am Jacqueline Keeler, your host. I'd like to say, greet you in my own language, Yak-eh, Shake, Dolish, the Ne'eh, She'e, Jacqueline Keeler, Yunishia. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. In the Navajo way, we also introduce ourselves through our clans. I am a member of the Navajo Nation, also known as the Diné people, through my mother, and I am Yankton Sioux, which are called Dakota Lakota in our language, Yohonsalan Dakota. So I'd also like to acknowledge, and my clan is Kia'ani, Towering House Clan. I'd also like to acknowledge that we are in what is now called Portland, Oregon. We are on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kaiapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. So there's this question I ask in every episode of American Standoff, and that is that since the year that's passed, since January 6, 2021, what have we all learned from this? And so this week, we faced another sort of shock with the very real prospect that Roe v. Wade could be overturned this year. These questions have become more pressing than ever as to what does this sort of conservative onslaught that has even become actually violent and militarized could be to more than 50% of the population of this country, namely women, right? So today, May 5th, 2022, we are remembering missing and murdered Indigenous women, and there is right now a national call to action regarding this. Here's some history about why the U.S. Senate designated this day to honor missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. In 2017, the U.S. Senate signed a resolution that designated May 5th as the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Native Women and Girls. Senator Steve Daines, a Republican from Montana, introduced the resolution in response to the disappearance and death of Hannah Harris, a citizen of the Northern Cheyenne tribe. Harris was reported missing in Lane Deer, Montana by her family on July 5, 2013. Her body was found 5 days earlier, 5 days later. Hannah Harris was determined to have been raped and murdered, and the individuals accused of committing those crimes were convicted, the resolution states. The case of Hannah Harris is an example of many similar cases. May 5th was designated the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls because Harris was born on May 5th, 1992. This is to honor her birthday. The resolution calls for people to demonstrate solidarity with the families of victims, as well as to honor the lives of the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, both those whose cases are documented and undocumented in public records and the media. Events are being held at local, state, and national level by advocates and organizations in hopes of allowing people to reflect on the movement and also discuss the work that needs to be done. And there are events happening here in Portland. The city of Portland, it has declared this entire week MMIWP Awareness Week. That would be Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, because certainly Native men also go missing at a very high rate. And so the city of Portland has a website at portland.gov, which has all the different events that are happening this week. Today, it already started between 8 and 9:30. On Thursday today at 9:30, they have a Multnomah County Board proclamation occurred, and then today between 3 and 8. There is a day of awareness community gathering at South Hawthorne Waterfront Park. So that is today at 3 p.m. until 8 p.m. And you can go to South Hawthorne Waterfront Park, and there will be a gathering. And then tomorrow on Friday, May 6th, between 8 and 9:30 a.m., there is powwow yoga with Ecosia Redlock. And so all through the week, the Morrison Bridge and the Expo Center and Convention Center have been lit in the colors honoring missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so in Arizona, where my reservation is, the Navajo Nation, an Arizona mirror analysis looked at the WWIWG cases the MMIWG cases, sorry, found that more than 25% of murders involving Indigenous women in Arizona go unsolved. Additionally, the Murder Accountability Project found that 1 in 3 murders of Native Americans in Arizona goes unreported to the FBI. A 2017 study for the Urban Indian Health Institute found that Arizona has the third highest number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the country. The study reported a total of 506 known cases in 71 urban cities across the country, and 54 cases were identified in Arizona, which has Arizona is one of the highest percentages of Native people in statewide, and Alaska is also very high. In some tribal communities, women face murder rates that are more than 10 times the national average, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. And these are broken out by county. So in some counties, Native women have 10 times the rate of murder. And so there is no centralized database as of yet among the thousands of federal, state, and tribal entities in the U.S., but there are a few resources. So this issue has been made more problematic because of the very the jurisdictional issues between Indian country and states and the federal government, and this is actually creates a loophole for people for violent offenders to go to reservation land and not be prosecuted for the rape and murder of Native women and girls. So I've mentioned this before on the show that if I, as a Native woman who is a citizen of a federally recognized tribe, and this issue only pertains to people who are citizens of federally recognized tribes, Indian federal law only applies to citizens of federally recognized tribes, and there's a huge loophole which then allows us to be murdered and raped without any prosecution. I think they found the FBI declined to prosecute in 70% of the cases. And so if I went to the reservation and was there, I'd have a much higher chance of being murdered and raped with no accountability. And so this is a huge part of this driving these numbers. There have been things that have been happening to address that, namely the recent passage of VAWA in March, the re-upping of it, did increase the level of jurisdiction that tribes have over non-Native people, non-federally enrolled people. And so right now, tribes do not have a lot of jurisdiction over people who are not enrolled in federally recognized tribes. And then the NAMUS published a report in August finding that there are 734 unresolved missing Indigenous people's cases from 36 states. And the FBI publishes a roundup every year that highlights the total number of missing persons and unidentified person cases reported. In 2020, more than 9,500 cases involving Indigenous people were reported, and nearly 1,500 were still active cases at the end of the year. For murder rates among Indigenous peoples, the Interior Department reported that 2,700 cases of murder and non-negligent homicide offenses have been reported to the federal government's Uniform Crime Reporting Program. In 2017, homicide was reported as the fourth leading cause of death among Indigenous women between the ages of 1 and 19 years, and the sixth leading cause of death for ages 20 to 44, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And in a report from the National Institute of Justice, 84% of Indigenous women experience violence in their lifetime, compared to 71% of white women. And that's sort of a rundown by the numbers of what's going on with MIW in this country right now. And so this week is a call to action for the nation and the world to honor missing and murdered Indigenous women. And there are national organizations like the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center that have been organizing, who have organized a national week of action from April 29th to today, May 5th. And you can check out their website for more information. The website says the current systemic response to violence against Native women is inadequate, and the rate at which we are losing women is devastating to our tribal communities and to the nation as a whole. And so today I'm tying this episode about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, or missing even missing murdered Indigenous people, as the city of Portland is honoring it, to the recent leak of a preliminary vote of a conservative majority, a Supreme Court draft decision penned by Justice Samuel Alito that would strike down Roe v. Wade. So let's listen to, to segue a bit, let's listen to some more structural analysis about how we got to this point from Lawrence O'Donnell, in which he examines not only the Supreme Court, but how Alito's draft opinion quotes a man who believed in witches.
In infamy, Samuel Alito says on page one, the Constitution makes no mention of abortion. The Constitution also makes no mention of the right to travel. The government has never granted us the right to travel, yet we have always had it. Roe versus Wade linked the right to abortion services to the right to privacy, which we also always assumed that we have, but the Constitution doesn't mention a right to privacy, and Samuel Alito and a majority of the Supreme Court don't believe that you have a right to privacy, but they do believe that they have a right to privacy, which is why the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, for the first time in its history, has ordered an investigation of the very worst thing that has ever happened to the Supreme Court. The court's privacy has been invaded. The Chief Justice calls the violation of the court's privacy a, quote, egregious breach of trust. And that's how the Supreme Court feels when they lose their privacy. It's egregious for them. But they don't care how you feel when they take your privacy away. The private deliberations of the Supreme Court have been invaded by the leak of the Alito first draft of the revocation of a constitutional right. Samuel Alito says that a right to abortion services is not, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history. Women on the Supreme Court are not deeply rooted in this nation's history. Nowhere does the Constitution say that women can serve on the Supreme Court. Nowhere does the Constitution say that black people can serve on the Supreme Court. The founders thought only white men should ever serve on the Supreme Court. The founders were the original proponents of affirmative action exclusively for white men. The founders deeply and fervently believed in carrying out the mass murder of as many members of the native tribes of this continent and enslaving as many black people as was necessary for white men to reign supreme in this land. That is deeply rooted in this nation's history. If you are using deeply rooted in this nation's history as the basis for what you think is right and just, then you are lost. You are morally lost. Samuel Alito reaches back to legal writings in 17th century England to show that the right to abortion services is not deeply rooted in our history. He cites Sir Edward Coke writing in 1644, that abortion is a crime. In 1644 in England, they were still having witch trials, ending in the execution of the convicted witches. And Sir Edward Coke helped English law define witches when he rewrote English law in 1604 to make it even more cruel in witchcraft trials. He wrote, "A witch is a person who hath conference with the devil to consult with him or to do some act." So Samuel Alito is quoting approvingly the 1644 judgment on abortion of an English aristocrat who said, "A witch is a person who has conference with the devil." Samuel Alito is reaching back four centuries to use Sir Edward Coke as a moral authority on abortion, a man who believed in witches and believed they were working with the devil and believed that witches should be murdered by the state, and he helped make sure that they were murdered by the state in England. Samuel Alito needs to talk to the clerk working for him who found that reference to Sir Edward Coke and get that erased from his draft opinion. We were executing witches in this country as late as 1692. Men and women were given the death penalty in this country for being witches, mostly women, of course. Dorothy Goode was 4 years old when she was accused of being a witch in Massachusetts. So when you're justifying outlawing abortion because people conducting witch trials also believed abortion should be against the law, you are morally lost. That is what the twisted reasoning of Samuel Alito has delivered to us in the first Supreme Court opinion in history, revoking a constitutional right. For most presidents, the only thing they get to do that outlasts their presidency is appoint Supreme Court justices. Clarence Thomas's service on the Supreme Court is the only enduring thing from the presidency of George H.W. Bush. A vote for George H.W. Bush for president in 1988 has turned out to be a vote to revoke a constitutional right. His son, George W. Bush, created the Department of Homeland Security, which endures, and began wars that he could not complete. But his most enduring legacy is now the delivery of Samuel Alito to the United States Supreme Court, the first Supreme Court justice to write an opinion revoking a constitutional right. Donald Trump did something that no one-term president has ever done before. He appointed three Supreme Court justices. The last president to appoint three Supreme Court justices was Ronald Reagan, and it took him 8 years to do it. Donald Trump, the president least capable in our history of evaluating candidates for the United States Supreme Court, got to appoint three of them, and all three of them are voting to revoke a constitutional right. 70% of the country is opposed to what the Supreme Court is doing. In a democracy, this could never happen, but we do not live in a democracy because of the Electoral College and the United States Senate. The only way the Alito opinion can get a majority vote in the Supreme Court now is thanks to the Electoral College installing two Republican presidents who came in second with the voters. Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush, but George W. Bush got the presidency thanks to the Electoral College. Donald Trump came in second with the voters by a wide margin, but was installed in the presidency by the Electoral College. Democrats in the United States Senate represent far more people than Republicans represent, but both parties have the same number of seats in the United States Senate because of the profoundly anti-democratic formula that each state gets two senators. The 44 million people of California get two senators, and the 1.6 million people of the Dakotas get four. That is not democracy. That can never be democracy. And so 70% of the country is living tonight under the anguish and the weight of minority rule. 70% of the country is losing a constitutional right against their will. 70% of the country has had that constitutional right for their entire lives. But for Samuel Alito, that is not deeply rooted in this nation's history. There is one president in our history who was impeached twice and never won a majority vote in a presidential election, and he got to appoint the same number of justices as Ronald Reagan, who won 49 states in his reelection campaign. There is one president in our history who provoked serious public discussions of using the 25th Amendment to remove him from office, and he got to appoint three Supreme Court justices.
So was Lawrence O'Donnell discussing the Alito's draft opinion and how it quotes from a man who believed in witches. So, you know, I think Alito was trying to basically make the case that the right to abortion, you mentioned, is not in the Constitution. Of course, the Constitution was written by, 78 white men in 1783. And it doesn't mention a lot of things, like you said, doesn't mention our right to travel, even. There's a lot of things not mentioned in the Constitution. Once again, today we are discussing the MMIWG National Day of Action, which is today, May 5th, and the recent alarming news that Roe v. Wade may be struck down by the Supreme Court. Please do call in to be part of this conversation. Our studio number is 503-231-8187. And this is American Standoff, and I am Jacqueline Keeler, your host. And shockingly, I find myself in all this agreeing with Geraldo Rivera, of all people. He had a recent outburst on Fox News, which was retweeted by activist and writer Amy Siskin. She is the author of The List, A Week by Week Reckoning of Trump's First Year, and organizer of We the People March. She tweeted his comments writing, "Shame on Gorsuch, shame on Comey Barrett, shame on Kavanaugh for saying they would uphold Roe in confirmation hearings and then doing the opposite, saying they lied about it." So let's listen to Geraldo.
Both parties and give their reasons why they are fit to be on the high court. More problematic, I think, and Judge, I think you'd agree with me. What this shows, because it goes both ways, what this shows is that the Senate confirmation process by which a nominee is interrogated by both parties and give their reasons why they are fit to be on the high court is absolutely deeply flawed. Why? Because these nominees lie. Whoa. They go before the Senate of the United States. They swear that they're going to be judicious and good, shepherds of the court and its impartiality and the importance it has in American society, and that the stare decisis, that the precedent of these cases well established. 30 years, 40 years, 49 years, that is something that the Supreme Court honors. And then they turn around the minute they get in the high court, they make a decision that is so dramatically opposed to what they said during the confirmation hearings. Shame on them. Shame on Gorsuch. Shame on Coney Barrett. Shame on Kavanaugh. They knew when they were swearing to those senators or in the conversations in the Senate offices that they were going to vote to reverse or overthrow Roe v. Wade. They knew it, and they lied about it. And I don't know how you fix that. I don't know how you can repair when the most sacred office in the land, the High Court of the United States, is peopled by politicians.
So that was Geraldo actually going off on the whole issue and addressing the lies sort of put forward in the congressional hearings that these Trump Supreme Court nominees went through and Comey Barrett and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and how they actually went asked if they would be. How they would vote, if they would uphold Roe v. Wade, they all said that they would in their hearings. And of course, some Comey Barrett, wrote a whole legal piece talking about how her Catholicism would, which she regarded all abortions as abhorrent. And so I think that maybe senators, like I know Senator from Alaska. And the senator from Maine, but they both are being sort of having their feet held over the fire because they were willing to be to take them at their word in the hearings, even though they knew and Trump announced that these candidates, particularly Amy Comey Barrett, that they were being put in place to overturn Roe v. Wade. Trump had said that explicitly. So we have a caller, Susanna.
Yes, hi. I was appalled when a local politician running for the Northwest of Oregon State Senate seat, Suzanne Weber, on a candidates forum, stated in asking her opinion on choice, she said, "I'm for choice from conception to natural death, period." And that's all she said. And I pondered it, thinking, why those choice of words? Choice to me was a boondoggle to maybe make somebody vote for her, but from conception to natural death means no morning after pill, no IUD, some of the hormonal birth controls, make a conceived egg not implant. It was really frightening, I thought, and she was the Tillamook, I think the mayor of Tillamook, and then she's been a state rep, and now she wants to be our state senator from this area. It's very upsetting.
Wow. Yeah, this notion that there's all these people who oppose Roe v. Wade, polls consistently find that by nearly a 2-to-1 margin, voters oppose overturning Roe v. Wade. And that was from, came from a new Political Morning Consult poll that came out on May, well, just the other day. And so this was following the, after Politico had published the draft opinion from the Supreme Court that would eviscerate the 1973 precedent guaranteeing federal abortion rights. So there is a huge amount of support for the law in the country. But as Lawrence O'Donnell pointed out, these folks making these decisions don't represent the majority of the country. You know, if you even look at, you know, he was making a point about the Senate, you know, the, you know, four senators for South and North Dakota, which has a population together, these two states, of just like over 1.5 million people. While you have a state like California with 44 million people, and they only have two senators. Like, and how is that representation? You know, and even in the greatest stretch of your imagination, how can that be real representation? Four senators for just a little over 1 million people, and then two senators for 44 million people. And so, you know, and of course the justices that are, that signed off on this, you know, they were appointed by most of the Supreme Court, the majority, the conservative majority, what were including Roberts, who did not, who was not signing off on, who was not listed as having done a preliminary vote in favor of this decision. You know, were all appointed by minority elected presidents, George W. Bush and Trump, right? Neither of whom won a majority of the vote. And so, this is rule by the few over the many. And so it's, yeah, it's, and there's some really great studies that have looked at the sort of origins of this, in particularly the fights following the passage of anti-segregation laws, and how the white supremacists, turned to this sort of, before this, you know, most Republicans, Republican Party supported the right to choose, and so did many. I think I saw a quote from like the president of the Baptist Convention in the 1950s supported abortion rights. And so the big change happened when they realized it was a political football they could sort of use as a wedge issue to maintain power. And so that's why there's this sort of everyone, you know, all of these. Folks, the Supreme Court justices who came through the Federalist Society, you know, all have this. This is something that they had to basically swear allegiance to this issue and be partisan. And as Geraldo said, you know, we basically have politicians in the Supreme Court, which I imagine was always the case, but this is much more blatant now. And so you know, this is really reduces the sort of the Supreme Court's I guess you know, prestige, basically what it has, and as an arbiter. And so they this is where we're at right now. So thank you so much Susanna, for calling in. So all of this, you know, brings to mind not only TV shows like The Handmaid's Tale, but once again, I want to bring this back to missing murdered Indigenous women, right? So in 2006 in South Dakota, that year, many of you may have forgotten, that was 16 years ago, but the state legislature outlawed access to abortions, shutting down the only Planned Parenthood clinic in the state. It was in this atmosphere of loss of rights over women's right to choose that Cecilia Firethunder, the first woman to be elected president of the Oglala Sioux tribe, announced that she would build an abortion clinic on her own Peace family's land on the reservation for the women of South Dakota. Right? State law does not apply on the reservation; only federal law applies. And this is sort of a I looked a little bit into this. I spoke to my uncle, who is a law professor, and also another Native law professor who used to be at Lewis and Clark. He's now at ASU, Arizona State. The issue of how state law applies in reservations is kind of complicated, and I might go in a bit more into that later, because there, you know, this idea that the reservations could be a place in red states where clinics could be set up and serve women of the state was something I was sort of looking at. I'm writing an article about this, but because of what I mentioned before, whereby tribes do not have jurisdiction over non-federally enrolled people, therefore that's where state law then does apply to people on the reservation, on some reservations. And so, and then also in public law 280 states, which actually in the 1950s, this law was passed and actually gave several states jurisdiction over reservation land, and some of the, and that can also be appealed by the reservations of those states. Here in Oregon is a public law 280 state, so Oregon state law, Oregon does have jurisdiction over reservations, except for the Warm Springs Reservation, which has gotten out of that situation, but of course Oregon has one of the most liberal laws in the country, and so that is not really an issue here. Other states it's much more problematic, and so I think when you're looking at states like Idaho or even Wisconsin. And certainly the Dakotas, but South and North Dakota aren't really public law 280 states, but there are some reservations that are under that, but not all. So it's a bit murky, this sort of tactic. So I actually wanted to listen to a trailer for an ITV independent television video service documentary that premiered on PBS called Young Lakota, which talks about Cecilia Fire Thunder and how this issue impacted the reservation, and it's told from the perspective. The main person in the series is a young Lakota woman named Sunny, and from what she's going through as a young woman trying to decide, becoming an activist and becoming a feminist on the reservation. So let's listen to the audio from that trailer.
Why would you think a child would ruin your life? Wouldn't it make it better? She didn't see it that way, and I felt bad for that because I'm her kid. Life expectancy is 4 years less than overall U.S. population here on reservation, and the death rates are 670% higher. You were not expected to do much. Have kids and take care of them.
Ethan.
My girlfriend and I, we had kids.
With some, a bitch, it's tough.
Like that guy right there, he won't wear cheap diapers. $20 there, a pop.
Okay, apparently it got cut off there. I thought that I had the whole thing. I only deleted a little. I was only trying to delete a word because it was a word that we can't broadcast. So, I linked to the trailer on the webpage for this. I also put a link to the City of Portland's MIW events for today and tomorrow. But I do urge you to watch it. It's a really wonderful trailer, and it really gets into the heart of what was going on there in 2006. So I also wrote about this at the time for my blog, Tiushbaya Now. That's sort of a portmanteau I created, including the Dakota word for an encampment of teepees, Tiushbaya. In a post I titled, and this was in 2006, Fire Thunder, Impeachment, and the Rights of Women. And if you don't mind, I think I will read from it right now. I actually wrote this when my children were very small. And these are my thoughts at the time about the, these rights and their traditional basis. So I'm going to start. This is an article titled Fire Thunder, Impeachment and the Rights of Women. And I wrote this in July of 2006, and it's still up on my blog, Tiushbaya Now. I begin to realize more and more how out of step I am with the majority of Native Americans. The thin veneer of Native American activists, liberal or educated Indigenous folk like myself, have done much to promote the idea of an enlightened Indigenous tradition that was lost to U.S. imperialism, So now faced with the impeachment of the Oglala Sioux Tribal President Cecilia Firethunder in South Dakota for doing nothing more than proposing a Planned Parenthood clinic on her own land calls into question the assumptions that I have long held about my own people. President Firethunder stood up for the woman for women's right to choose under the flag of tribal sovereignty in opposition to the state of South Dakota's new anti-abortion law, which outlaws abortion in the case of rape or incest. Tribal sovereignty as it exists now under U.S. constitutional law arises out of an 1831 Supreme Court ruling that determined the legal status of tribes to be, quote, domestic dependent nations. It laid the precedent that states occupying a lower tier than tribes could not exert jurisdiction over these domestic dependent nations. The federal government alone enjoys this power. In addition to impeaching the president, the Oglala Tribal Council went one step further than the state of South Dakota, not only making abortion illegal, but they made seeking an abortion or helping someone find an abortion punishable by banishment from the reservation. So if a young woman is a victim of incest or rape and seeks help from another woman to find an abortion clinic, she and her friend would be banished. Meanwhile, the Tribal Council resists efforts to deal as stringently with the issue of rape, incest, and violence against women, so the men who perpetuate rape are not similarly punished. When I say my own people, I must clarify that I am not Oglala Lakota, but a Navajo tribal member, and my father is Yankton Dakota Sioux. My father's tribe is a member of what was once called in history books as the Great Sioux Nation, which included the Tetons, as well as of which the Oglala are a subgroup. And I know my dad's tribe, located some 200 miles across the state of South Dakota, are not so different from their cousins west of the Missouri River in cultural ideas and perceptions. In the parlance of my mother's people, I am born for the Yankton Dakota. However, as we are matrilineal, I am considered to be fully a member of my mother's clan and people. Boys are considered only half members, and traditionally would grow up to live with their wife's people, and their children would be of her clan. The Sioux or Lakota Dakota have always been more egalitarian in their approach to lineages, living equally with one side or the other. Grandparents often followed their children and grandchildren and were called chow followers. Like grandparents in any community, they enjoy gushing about their little ones and not wanting to be parted from them, followed them on long Indian visits from October until April to the in-laws encampment. But today, the United States insists that parents from different tribes like mine can only enroll their children in one tribe. So my parents, after much soul searching, chose to enroll my sisters and me in the Navajo tribe. Despite the federal designation, I have always felt a great affinity to my Yankton side. The writings of my great-great-aunt, Ella Deloria, were a revelation to me about what society could be and mean to the individual. She was fluent in all three dialects of Lakota, Dakota, Nakota. My great-aunt interviewed elders in the early 20th century on reservations in Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota. She recorded their recollections of traditional culture in their own words, and then translated them verbatim into English, and then did a second translation, retaining the idiomatic flavor. Her work has served as a solid foundation for future cultural scholars. In college, her books were taught in my Native American Studies courses. For my senior thesis, I sought out unpublished manuscripts held in collections of the University of South Dakota and the Southwest Museum of the American Indian in Los Angeles and the Dakota Indian Foundation in Chamberlain, South Dakota. My thesis was quite naturally on Yankton womanhood, and I made a note of everything that would help me understand the role of women in Dakota society. I learned things in my culture that were no longer being taught. Later, when I participated in Lakota ceremonies, I duly noted the differences, particularly in the role women played. Some of the changes were progressive, others painfully regressive. I found that many of the leaders today of the Wiyong Washipi, or Sundance, as it is called in English, were not Lakota. They had become active in Lakota ceremonies after stints in prison or after hard living had brought them to this way of life in order to forge a more emotionally honest and stable lifestyle. To be honest, some Lakota men and men of other tribes seem to derive a lot of personal gain from participating, not so much monetarily, but in personal power over followers and positions of prestige within their spiritual groups. It is somewhat similar to the guru position enjoyed by some traditional spiritual practitioners in India with similar New Age followers. The lack of knowledge of historical Lakota cultural structure meant that a lot of misinformation was spread and foisted upon these followers who were willing to put up with a lot to have an authentic Native American experience. I found myself challenging these misconceptions with personal family stories and research. I was shocked that generally progressive feminist women were allowing themselves to be bullied by tradition into regressive roles. None of the participants had ever read any of my great aunt's writings, although some Wichasha Wakan holy men told me they had read and been inspired by the writings of her nephew, Vine Deloria Jr., particularly God is Red, A Native View of Religion, and Custer Died for Your Sins, An Indian Manifesto. I know many women in different movements have encountered this experience. They join a movement and find themselves, despite their education and intellect, being expected to make the coffee and clean the dishes while male leaders sit around and hold councils and reenact the old days. The modern feminist movement was born of this experience of civil rights and the free speech movements. But progressive women seek traditional indigenous knowledge disadvantage. They can only, to a limited extent, bring their ideas of womanhood to the table, and for the most part must accede to the superior knowledge of the most likely male traditionalists. My great aunt's descriptions of Lakota life are eloquently encapsulated in two of her books, the ethnographic novel Water Lily and the other more polemical work Speaking of Indians, more in the vein of her famous nephew. The first time I read Water Lily, I cried. I felt a profound loss for something I had never known. I had lost my place in the community to which I could have belonged entirely in a way that I could not in this fractured Anglo-centric society. I remember in my Native American studies class, a white male student who mocked the descriptions of Lakota society in Water Lily, saying that the author had to have made up such a perfect society since everyone knows Indian communities were unfair and brutal places to live. Professor Elaine A. Yonner, who had edited a book on Ella Deloria's translations and studied under her, stated simply and firmly that nothing was made up. Everything was precisely as she has documented it. But was everything as perfect as she documented it? There was even in earlier days a reconstruction of Lakota society going on, a reinterpretation as seen in George Sword's narratives and translated by Ella, working for the father of American anthropology, Franz Boas. George Sword was a Lakota man who was literate in Lakota and wrote these stories down between 1890 and 1910. Later, when Ella tried to verify the stories by going back to the reservations in the 1920s, no one could recall ever hearing the stories told that way before. He had reinvented them to fit the conventions of European fairy tales. No one had ever told the stories that personify the sun and other figures of cosmology. It was a revolutionary development, something Sword pursued as a way of preserving the spirit of the stories, yet translating them into new cultural idioms for future generations to enjoy. Elaine Yonner delighted in telling the story about an elder in Montana who was the last in her tribe to know the old stories. She visited at the grandson's request because his grandmother wouldn't tell him the stories. He hoped that Yonner, his teacher, would have better luck and be able to record the stories before his grandmother died. When she entered the grandmother's cabin, she was given a book to read. This was a published account done years earlier of the tribe's stories. She instructed Yonner to read the book to her, and every time she disagreed with something in the book, she would bring her cane down on the floor and roughly poke Elaine with it. Finally, she said, "No more. See, that's why I won't tell my stories. I'm going to die with them intact." Once when I asked my Uncle Vine Deloria Jr. what his aunt had told him about the old traditions, he shook his head and told me that she wouldn't tell him anything. She said that she'd rather die with the information than have the next generation get it all wrong. She said these things were so important to the elders she knew, and they held them so dear that it would be worse to see them misinterpreted than to see them die out completely. I was utterly frustrated by this attitude. It was the opposite of the method of learning and education I'd received in school. I talked to my relative, Phil Lane Sr., my grandmother's cousin, but who was more like a grandfather to me. My old grandfather had died when my dad was 15, so I never knew him. Often traditionally, the mother's brother is the one who plays the role of instructing his sister's children. In the Navajo way, he is their clan relative, and of course the father is not. Although my dad's tribe is not matrilineal, the uncle still plays this role. So in a way, my grandmother's male relative, as her brothers were all dead, he was just fulfilling an age-old duty, being an uncle to my father and a lala, grandfather to his children. When I told him these stories that I'd heard at school and how they had upset me, he just laughed. He explained to me that traditionally they taught in a different way. It wasn't like in school where everyone is taught the same things at the same time, whether they are ready for it or not. Each individual was evaluated by the elder, and then it was determined whether they should know a story or any sort of lesson. He also told me how it was considered extremely impolite to ask someone a question. You waited until they told you. You just figured if they wanted you to know, they would tell you. If you really needed to know something, that information would be revealed to you by a vision, a teacher, or through observing nature. So the grandmother's actions showed that she had judged her grandson not ready to know the stories, and that she had confidence in future generations to discover those stories that were important to them on their own through methods available to them. This certainly made me feel better, but I still just wanted to know the traditions and have them told to me. So, but really, it was up on the hill and on a vision quest fasting that I came to understand this way of thinking, seeking a vision of my own. I came to understand how hard won these insights were and how beloved society was to those that had lost it. It was, as my great aunt said, a way of life that worked. And I would add for them, because each generation must find their own way, their own traditions that work for them at this time. Our elders wanted us to do it that way. We cannot, as modern Lakota, Dakota, or even Dene or American women, be constrained by them. We can be informed by them, even inspired, but we must make decisions for our own bodies, our future, our well-being that are sensible and that show that we value ourselves. We as women are more than our biology. We are more than just baby machines for a Lakota nation, a Dakota nation, or a Nakota nation. We are productive members of society. We are the ones earning the college degrees, holding the jobs, and are the ones, by and large, that must raise the children, earn wages to buy them shoes, and pay for their futures. We must be the ones to be able to make these choices concerning our bodies. It may be tradition to do this or that according to this person or that, but we must look clearly at what future we are dealing our young women when we assign them this lot so early in life, especially if that child is from rape or incest. Women are capable of knowing whether they have the resources to give a child a good life. Unless they are able to make that choice, the continued cycle of grinding poverty will continue to spiral out of control. This is not about killing babies, but about growing strong families that have the resources to take care of each other. If we speak of a tradition that values life, we must also speak of a tradition that valued self-control. Lakota, Dakota men were taught to control their sexual drive. Traditionally, a man was not a man unless he could control himself. A couple that had children closer than 4 years apart faced deep shame in the community. It was regarded and called killing the child. Children were supposed to be spaced 4 years apart. Any less and you endangered the older child. It was a shame that stayed with the killed child for the rest of their lives. People who knew would look upon that child with pity. Even in old age, it would be remembered how the parents had disrespected their elder child. So when we talk about tradition, we must realize that it cannot work in bits and pieces, and that even if wholly intact, it may not work at all today. If women must not commit abortion, then Lakota men on the reservation must practice this traditional form of manhood and have strict control of their sexual desire drive. The reason women on the reservation face some of the highest rates of rape and incest in the country is because men obviously do not practice this. One gender cannot pay the price for a broken society, and we cannot ignore the real price women pay and that children pay raised in difficult circumstances. Raising children is no small feat, and periods of pregnancy and childbirth mark periods of the greatest economic stress for families in the United States on or off the reservation. Expectant parents in the United States are more likely to slide below the poverty level. Women in the workforce, educated or not, are more likely to face negative job performance reviews when they are pregnant. Society punishes men for veering from the male norm. Asking women to bear children so that no Lakota fetus may be killed sounds noble, but does it change anything? The Ogallala Sioux tribe resides in, Shannon County, it's now Ogallala County, consistently ranked as the poorest county in the nation. Resources are scarce, unemployment at 85%. Pregnancy reduces the chance of young women to get an education, provide for their children, and improve the economic status of future generations. Even for college-educated women, paying for childcare can be an expensive proposition, and expecting grandma or some other female relative to stay home and watch the children is not always feasible, as most of the tribal members who hold jobs on the reservation are female. Most of the college degrees held by tribal members are held by women, yet most of the tribal council is male. There was a certain pragmatism to the old Lakota, Dakota traditions perceptible in the harsh community condemnation of parents who bore children too close together. It is obvious that they value the life that already exists more than that might be, that they held self-evident that parents in the community should do everything in their power to ensure the well-being of the children who already exist, to not only survive, but thrive. How is the Ogallala Nation doing this today if they do not value the lives and potentiality of their women? Why are they willing to create a generation of killed women, even of killed children, as many of these young women are little more than children themselves? I'm a mother. I am raising two children. The effort and daily investment in each child is great, even after only a few years of motherhood. I value my children, and as such, I value their potential. I would never demand my daughter as a teenager bear a child of rape or incest. It would be devaluing her. It would be killing her, because I am forcing into life another life before the present is able to bear it. That was something that our ancestors understood, perhaps better than we do now. And if we create a society of our own today that we love and enjoy and raise children who are beautiful and safe from harm, are we not truly then following in our ancestors' footsteps? Isn't that really the kind of society they would have understood and valued? Isn't that, after all, what they hoped and prayed for in those tumultuous last days before the hoop was broken? And so that's what I wrote in 2006. It's a bit odd reading it again all these years later. And it's a strong statement. I have to say that I was very upset about the impeachment of Cecilia Fire Thunder by the Ogallala Sioux Tribal Council, and I respect her stance, and I respect her, and so I do urge you to watch the documentary Young Lakota, if you can, and you'll see more of her in it. And you know, as we're entering, you know, this week where we're thinking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, right, and how we value Native women and girls and children and families, you know, we have to remember that, you know, we always have to value the life that is, you know, what, and all studies show that that women who are able to make the choice, that I know a study came out that women who are denied an abortion actually are more likely to think, like 45% greater chance to sink into poverty. 45%. If you could reduce poverty by 45%, you know, would you do it? You know, and also a study that came out in 2012, actually from my dad's reservation, from the Yankton Sioux Reservation, found that 85% of young women who had sex had done it without their consent, that they had, it was not consensual. So these young women who maybe end up being pregnant at a young age, you know, they are not, this is violence that's being done to them, and that they should have